You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 10th of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
A genuine leader, true partner and friend. It's a Biden-Kishida bromance. And Arizona takes abortion rights back to the 19th century. I'm Guy Delaunay. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Guy Delaunay. My guests Patricia Cohen and Sean Ryan will discuss the day's big stories. We'll be looking at a possible British ban on teenage telephone time, the relaunch of a much-loved gourmand's Bible, and how a German art gallery made an unexpected find but lost its sense of humour. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily, and I'm Guy Delaunay. I'm joined today by Patricia Cohen, who's the Global Economics Correspondent at The New York Times, and by Sean Ryan, the Director of Media at Save the Children, and he's also the former Sunday Times Foreign Editor. Greetings to both of you.
Greetings to you.
Hello there.
And we were just kicking it around, Patty, because, you know, I've got Patricia in my script, Patty's in the call list, and asked you which was which, and you said, well, whichever.
Well, you know, I like to go by Patricia because that's my byline. And so if people are looking for my byline, they'll know to look for that. But Patty is what I use with friends. So, but now that you've introduced me to our listening audience, they're all my friends and we can use
that's
Patty.
It. We can be familiar.
Exactly.
This is the important thing. Sean, do you face any such dilemmas yourself when it comes to the old moniker?
I don't like my name to be shortened to shh, but I do get a lot of that when I'm talking too much in the office.
You know, it strikes me, I was thinking earlier today, not apropos this at all, but I was thinking of these actors and people in the media who, because their names have been used, their names have been taken, almost like an internet domain thing. So I presume that's how you end up with things like Sarah Michelle Gellar. I'm presuming her other half or her children or her mother or whoever it is doesn't say, hey, Sarah Michelle, the whole time, unless they're telling her off, perhaps.
People like to be distinctive, don't they? That's how they get their fame. If they want to be called Kiney because they've earned that status, then good luck to them.
I'm always tempted, since I moved here a couple of years ago, whenever you have to do a restaurant reservation or something and they ask for the title. And, you know, here you have kind of like lady and lord and all of that. And I'm always tempted to kind of do lady or something because it just seems so, you know, unusual.
I've done something with one of my banking apps. It asked me how I wished to be known, and I told it. Do you know what I told it? Oh, great, mighty, and virile one.
And, so and did it comply?
Every time I open up my banking app, it says, hello, oh, great, mighty, and virile one.
I love that.
And I think we should all do this. I think, you know, we should treat ourselves as we want the world to treat us. And that's enough about me. Thank you very much.
Let's see if it still calls you virile when you're 70 and 80 years old.
There are pills for that. Enough of the frivolity. Let's... We've got very much an American sort of flavour to this, which I know both of your expertise will come into play here. And it really is an international flavour to start with, because Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is making his first official visit to the United States, and he's received a rapturous welcome from Joe Biden. He came on all Dwight Eisenhower, in fact, Joe Biden. He said, noted that Eisenhower wanted to establish an indestructible partnership between the two countries. Now, this is bearing in mind that the United States had been occupying Japan under the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. And he said, Joe Biden, this is, that today's relationship between Japan and the United States is unbreakable. Now, the strong words, the steel behind them, with defense issues in the Asia-Pacific region very much on the agenda, as well as Japan's production of military equipment. So I guess the question I'd like to start with, Patty, is anybody saying China out loud, or we're all just assuming that's what's in the background?
Oh, I think everyone's saying China out loud. I mean, that's clearly the backdrop for this. It's also important to remember, you know, Japan and the United States have since the post-war era always had a strong connection. They've had defense pact, certainly two things that have happened in recent years. One was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has put everybody, more particularly in Europe, of course, but on a much more aggressive military footing and increasing defense expenditures. And we see the revolution that that's caused in Germany. Well, there's something similar going on in Japan because, of course, even though Japan is further away, there's been this concern since then that this will kind of embolden China. And China has already been more aggressive in terms of claiming area in the South China Seas and such. And so I also think it's a little bit of insurance before the November election in case Trump gets elected. He's very much a wild card in terms of foreign relations. Yeah. And I think the idea is to kind of, to the degree possible, solidify that pact with Japan before he comes in, if he comes in.
You shot the fox of my next question.
Oh, sorry about
that. It's okay. It's actually, it works well as a kind of lead on, and I'll lead it on to Sean, I mean, which is, I suppose the question is, unbreakable is a big word. How unbreakable is this relationship if Donald Trump were to get in?
Well, he's a wild card, isn't he? And some people think that he might want to form an agreement with China that would make the region very unstable. So this is a really important meeting in Washington. It's so important to Joe Biden that apparently the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida quite likes Paul Simon, and the great man is being wheeled out at the state dinner to perform. And the hope there is that Biden will have, as of tomorrow, the presence of Philippines as well as the Prime Minister of Japan. The three of them can form some sort of pact about what to do in the Pacific, and that instead of China trying to isolate Japan and the Philippines in the Pacific, those three will be trying to isolate China. And then we'll see where we go. We'll see what happens next in this big diplomatic and military game. But there's a huge amount of pressure developing on Japan to increase its production of weapons and to expand its military. And the US clearly knows that it will need allies if China continues to try to cause trouble over strategic waterways and even contemplates an offensive on Japan, on Taiwan.
Of course, it's a pity that it's not President Gore, because then Paul Simon could have played You Can Call Me Al. Had to do it.
I think he might be calling for a bridge over troubled water, which might have something to do with the content of the dinner.
There we go. And I was thinking of the relationship maybe between the United States and Japan, a mother and child reunion would be another one. But, you know, we could play this game.
I think there's a soundtrack that should accompany this podcast.
It should be, maybe we should do, absolutely, we should do playlists to go along with the new stories. in terms of, you're talking about how big a deal Joe Biden's making of it. You know, Paul Simon's been brought in, so it's obviously a huge deal. But who's doing who the favour here? Or is this really truly a mutual benefit that you've got this relationship between the United States and Japan and this military alliance between them?
Oh, I think it's clearly a mutual benefit. I mean, Japan has even been talking to Europe about becoming involved in developing the next generation fighter jets, giving more money to it. So there's, although I don't think the pressure is as great as in Germany, there's also, as you mentioned, this pressure to spend more militarily. And you know, Japan, I think, like a lot of countries in that region, are interested in strengthening ties with each other and having a both for trade as well as for defense purposes.
It's been not an untroubled relationship, this military relationship between Japan and the U.S. I mean, there's been sentiment within Japan over the years that there was rather too much U.S. presence in Japan. There's been, certainly under Shinzo Abe, there was a big push for Japan to make its self-defense forces something a bit less self-defensive, perhaps. Where are we now? Are we now coming to the realization in Japan, perhaps, that the US is really required for the security of Japan and also the wider Asia-Pacific region?
The tensions you talked about came to a head when it was alleged that a Japanese woman was raped by an American soldier. There was an outcry in Japan and a lot of very strong anti-American sentiment. That seems like a distant memory now. And the more China's strength is coming to the fore, the greater the concern about China across the Indo-Pacific, the more Japan has an incentive to have very close ties with America. And from the American perspective, they can see that there's a China-Russia alliance building, even with North Korea. So you've got these big power blocks hardening in both Europe and the Pacific. And that's something that the Americans really need to keep on top of, because they can't afford to be weak in either Europe or the Pacific.
Have we got any expertise around the table about Japan's military-industrial complex? Because I know recently, the most recent thing I read was Mitsubishi abandoning its plans for civil aircraft that did try to produce a short-range aircraft similar to, I don't know, a Bombardier or something like that, and had decided it didn't have the expertise. So was the expertise more on the military line of things?
Well, I wonder, now that you're mentioning that, if that's part of the impetus with Japan teaming up with Britain and some other countries in terms of developing their next-generation fighter jet capabilities. And so the idea that perhaps Japan does not have to do this on its own, and also there's, although obviously Japan's not part of NATO, but just there's very much interest, increased interest in having interoperability between military weapons and parts and such. And Japan may have an eye on that as well, just in terms of future military spending.
And in terms of Donald Trump, we mentioned him as the wild card coming up, but Joe Biden talking up this meeting, is there domestic... My professor at university donkeys years ago when I was doing American history, one of the wisest lines I think he came out with was American elections are never won on foreign policy. So is there any mileage for Joe Biden in talking up this relationship, in talking up, I suppose, himself or showing himself to be a statesman who places great importance on America's allies and what they can bring to global security?
I don't think so. In this context, particularly not. I mean, foreign policy, but Biden's perhaps his strongest, record is on foreign policy. And he's had ample opportunity, unfortunately, over the past 3 years to show that leadership, which has in some quarters been championed and in some criticized. But I think it'll be much more on domestic issues, like perhaps the next our next topic for conversation, which is abortion. So, no, I don't think it's going to have any impact.
Patty, you're moving me on again. But it's fair enough, because also Tom was waving through the window at me. So we are going to move on and stay in the US, though, because abortion restrictions, if we're talking about vote winners, well, they haven't exactly been a vote winner for the Republican Party. And that's why Donald Trump probably hasn't given his backing for a national policy. But he probably won't have been thrilled by the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling taking abortion rights back to the 19th century. And I mean that quite literally. The judges have resurrected a law from 1864, which bans nearly all abortions unless the life of the mother is in danger. And this isn't perhaps what Mr. Trump was hoping for when he said that states should be left to handle the issue. So, Sean, what is the upshot, first of all, on this what the Arizona State Supreme Court has been saying?
Well, on Monday, Trump declined an opportunity to side with his evangelical right support and come out in favour of a national ban on abortion, saying that the decision should be left to the states. And then the very next day, Arizona has come up with what most people would regard as quite an extreme interpretation of the law to introduce effectively a ban. So that has brought the issue back to life in a way that Trump did not want, because he hoped to diffuse it with his comments on Monday and the idea of let the states decide. And he's now in a position where he is very vulnerable, I think, to Biden and Harris talking about abortion as an area where people's freedom is under threat from Trump. And that could become quite a potent political issue. It's particularly important to female voters. So remember when Trump did win the election, he won, I think they decided in the end, 39% of the female vote. And white suburban women are regarded as a key demographic in the election in November. So whether Trump can maintain his support enough to secure victory remains to be seen. And it looks to me as if abortion is becoming a bigger issue than anyone might have expected, because usually, Patty, it's the economy, stupid.
I mean, is there a possibility? I know Sean's just wanting to bat the economy back to you there. Why don't we just let Sean do that, actually? Go ahead. Why do I need to say anything? Go for it, Patty.
So I do think the economy will be an important issue. I think abortion is a more important issue than it was in the last election. I don't think that it's probably going to be as important as the Democrats hope. In fact, we had the Times had a few people on the ground in Arizona interviewing people, and there were several people that they talked to who are against the Arizona, the latest ruling, are pro-choice, but nonetheless are still going to stick with Trump. And part of it has to do with how polarized American politics are now. And secondly, how also I think that most voters, and I think this is traditionally the case, although maybe not in extreme times, but are not single issue voters as much as they may feel strongly. So while I do think it's going to help margins in some places, we've seen it in some state elections, but we've also seen that it hasn't moved, kind of voting that much, even on whether it's the judiciary level or on the governor level.
Perhaps this is the skirmishing before the main battle, because you've got Trump really pushing the agenda on the border, the migrants and drugs coming across the border at the same time as Kamala Harris is talking about abortion. And ultimately, they will come onto the economy, won't they? And that may become still the main battleground for the votes.
I mean, you have this very strange phenomenon, which is all of the kind of traditional indicators, economic indicators, are quite good. Mm. And yet people, many Americans don't feel that way. So, again, I think this is a case where, again, politics has become so polarized that's the lens through which everyone is seeing the economy or abortion or whatever. And, if you are pro-Trump or a Republican, you have a much worse view of the economy than you would otherwise. And unfortunately, that's the context we're dealing in. I also want to point out that just two things you mentioned about the law. First of all, this law was enacted before Arizona was even a state. Mm. It goes back to 1864.
I was going to say, it's Civil War era, basically, isn't it?
Right, right. And so the state wasn't even, you're talking about like things that maybe, and there is talk about trying to enshrine the right in the state constitution. But secondly, there's already 21 states in which abortion is either completely banned or partially banned in terms of for a gestational period. And so I think it's unlikely to have a national ban, although what Trump has not spoken out on is whether there were a Republican Congress and a law were passed, would he veto it? And he has not. He's not spoken out on that issue.
I mean, is there a case of the U.S. Supreme Court potentially not exactly coming to Donald Trump's rescue, but making a ruling on this Arizona state Supreme Court ruling that might be helpful to Donald Trump?
I don't think it'll happen before the election in any event, just because of the time that things go. In fact, what the Arizona court did was actually make it go back to a lower court on a ruling for something. So, before it would then have to work its way back up to the Supreme Court, that would be probably long after the November election.
I think what we're also in danger, and I don't mean this of you, Patty, and you, Sean, but, we could be in danger of missing the big picture here, which is that women's rights here are the major casualty. We're talking about Donald Trump's chances at the ballot box and how this could all play out. How are women's rights now being squeezed in states like Arizona?
Well, they are being squeezed, and it's a thing that could become relevant. So Arizona is one of the most marginal swing states, and the polling there is extremely close. I think there's less than 1% between Trump and Biden there at the moment. So even if the election is decided on other issues, you can see a situation where a few votes might go the Democrats' way because of abortion, and that could be the thing that gives Trump his comeuppance in the end. What do you think about that, Patty?
I mean, I'm very reluctant ever to kind of give thoughts on how elections go, and we're famous, particularly when it comes for Trump, the media
this
for
far
being
out as well.
Yes, and also the even in, particularly in terms of Trump of being, you know, terribly wrong. I think, you know, it still is a ways to the November election. I think this is clearly a very potent issue. It's very motivating for a lot of women, but given the, you know, the way the electoral system is in the U.S., it's kind of how it plays out in certain states that are up for grabs and such. So I do think it will be a potent force. I don't know how that's going to turn the election one way or the other.
Well, I think what we're going to talk about now, again, it's maybe not a major election issue, but it shows that we're getting into that sort of territory in the United Kingdom, because the age of consent may soon apply to smartphones if ideas being floated by the British government come to fruition. And when I say floated, I mean these are the kind of newspapers reports which say ministers are considering. So I think we can see that's not so much of a policy just yet. But nonetheless, it's an idea that's got currency after the ban in Florida for smartphones for under 14s. And if the polls are to be believed, I mean, and these are the polls on the specific issue on a smartphone ban for under 16s in the United Kingdom, it's got the support of the majority of British parents who are understandably concerned about the mental health of their teenage children. Now, Sean, a Conservative government banning under 16 smartphone use seems a little bit off-brand, shall we say?
It is. People call it micro-parenting by the government, and it's back to the idea of the nanny state. But the government or ministers or officials briefing journalists, as you've described, are clearly tapping into this huge and growing concern about the impact of smartphones and social media on their children's mental health. So I have a daughter who was born in 2000. There is a book coming out by a guy called Jonathan Haidt, a professor of social science at NYU, and it looks like a great book. It's called Screen Children, and he's going to argue that in 2012, the mental health of an entire generation fell off a cliff. And in 2012, my own daughter was 12, and I can tell you she really suffered in her teens because she was looking at her phone late at night, and there was cyberbullying going on, and all sorts of things were happening that wouldn't have been happening without social media. And she has had a much harder childhood than my two older children, who didn't have to cope with Snapchat and Instagram late at night. So I think this professor is onto something, and he's actually calling for people not to be allowed to have access to phones before 14 and social media before 16. And I think it would be a very interesting thing to try that out and see if it reverses this incredible rise in anxiety, depression and self-harm that we've seen in the UK and the US.
And Patty, in the US, this, I don't know how far we've gone along with the ban in Florida. Is it in place yet? Is it operational?
I'm not sure about the specifics of that particular ban in Florida. I mean, I think there's a couple of different issues just to slice here. So there's one is the question of cell phones in school, which seems to me kind of an issue about learning during the day and distractions and discipline. But obviously, all of the other effects that you're talking about can certainly happen after school hours. So in that sense, I think those are two separate issues. It's very hard for me also, though, to see how you would enforce that kind of regulation. First of all, if, you know, I read this figure somewhere. I'm not sure exactly what the universe that of people that it applies to, but something like 97% of 12-year-olds have smartphones. So if parents are that against it, you know, they could not buy it. And being a parent, I know how hard it is to hold out against that kind of pressure. So, you know, in a way, you'd like the government to do it for you. But even so, let's say you did that. There's nothing to prevent a parent from buying a smartphone and giving it to their kid. I mean, how are you going to police that? So I do think, I mean, Haidt's a very interesting thinker. I don't know that I would totally go for his cause and effect. But I mean, it's certainly, we have seen a lot of the very insidious effects of social media. And I don't really think anybody has figured out how to get a handle on this and control it. And it's not only for children and adolescents, which is a very important issue. We see it in our discourse. I mean, look at the political discourse in America. Misinformation now, you know, from China and Russia, and as well as homegrown disinformation. I mean, it's a huge problem that we haven't don't know how to solve.
I mean, we've just to give you another quote from Jonathan Haidt, I mean, this book hasn't come out yet, but he's been interviewed. And one of the points he makes is you receive hundreds of notifications per day if you've got social media with the notifications turned on, many of which, and many of these people who've got these on, never have 10 minutes of uninterrupted time. You should ask these young people to turn off almost all notifications on their smartphones. And you see, I have conversations with my teenagers about regulation of social media, regulation of things like YouTube. And the point is, we had a bonfire of the regulations in the 1980s under Thatcher and Reagan. And this is what we're reaping now, in essence, because the internet came of age following the bonfire of regulations. Everybody's been extremely light touch with regards to internet companies throughout that time, whether it's Apple, Google, social media, whoever it is. And here we are. Now you have to suggest to a teenager that really YouTube should be regulated in the same way as broadcast media. That gets pushback. Well, why shouldn't I be able to watch anything I want to on YouTube and so forth? And where are the administrations who are going to have the courage to regulate against such deep-pocketed internet giants?
Yeah, the bonfire of regulations might have made life a bit easier for adults, but I think it's left young people, vulnerable young people, really exposed to whatever you can see on a smartphone. You can see porn, you can see people being murdered, you can see all sorts of things, and they do see those things.
Yep.
And I think it's very unfair that they are prone to all of that.
Seriously, Sean, I mean, this is part of your expertise. I mean, how many of these children, never mind, you know, the distraction and so forth from social media, how many are going to be suffering from things like PTSD because of what they've seen?
Yes, I think there's a great concern among child psychologists about the impact. It's a huge experiment, and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. In my daughter's case, she's turned out to be an outstanding 23-year-old woman, and no long-term harm has been done. But there's a huge amount of long-term harm in young adults that we're seeing who don't have the same skills in terms of personal relationships, don't have the same interest in being outdoors, don't really have the same mental development.
I mean, one thing that would seem to make sense, and I don't know what the technological capabilities of this is, the degree to which, you know, you could have parental controls, just like you have them on a television that can
And then
limit.
We can have the arguments with the people who've got the parental controls imposed on them.
Exactly. But you know, at least there is some tool that parents would have.
Indeed. And I should say, this idea of a smartphone ban for under-16s in Britain, I mean, yeah, the shelf life of Rishi Sunak's administration is, to say the least, limited. So I don't think we should hold our breath for that particular one to come true. Now then, onto the stuff of dreams, or at least very cheesy films. The recording studio dog's body who becomes a mega pop star, the cinema projectionist who makes the leap to directing, or the person who hangs the pictures in a gallery, becoming an acclaimed artist in their own right. Now that's presumably what a 51-year-old worker was hoping, dreaming of, when he installed one of his own paintings at Munich's Pinakothek de Modern. But in a spectacular sense of humour failure, the gallery not only took down the painting, but fired the worker, banned him from the gallery, and called the police to investigate for criminal damage. There's a reason why they call it a Kunsthaus.
I love this guy. I think, you know, we are happy when we're confident, and you're confident because you're banking up tells you every day that you're virile. But this guy is so confident in his artistic ability that he thinks that his art merits being hung alongside other artists displayed in that particular place, including Picasso and Max Ernst and Salvador Dali. You've got to love his confidence, and you've got to think there is a happy man who probably doesn't have any regrets, even though he's been fired and banned from the gallery.
I'm with you. I love this guy. I love this story. I think it's just terrible that the museum has sought, you know, to fire him and criminally prosecute him. And I would just like to bring up three things in which to think about this. Number one is, you know, there's a dimension of art which is always subversive, and that's you know, that's built into it. And artists throughout history have always gone to all kinds of lengths to get their art seen. I mean, Banksy did it all over public and private buildings. And it turns out people are totally thrilled with it now because he's become very, because he's become so successful. Number two, you know, how do things get to be hung in museums? Well, they're hung for a lot of reasons, not necessarily only because of their, you know, aesthetic or artistic value. Certainly in most museums and galleries, money has a big thing to do with it. A collector, a donor says, I'll give you this contribution if you put my work up, or I'll give you this Rembrandt if you also take this third class painting along the way, you know, so you get a tax deduction. Or they pushed for a showing of an artist that they own, because that in of itself will raise the value of that artist's work. And thirdly, you know, artists have been knowing this for years in terms of this, how we view a piece of art. Just because it's hung in a museum or in a gallery, it takes on a kind of veneer that it would not otherwise have. And of course, Duchamp is most famous for doing that by taking a toilet bowl and putting it in a museum, thereby automatically, instantaneously converting it from a bathroom fixture into a work of art. And so I think he's in this tradition of doing it.
Magritte is in there, actually. I'm just looking at the collection of the Pinacoteca Moderna, who's... name I horribly mangled in the introduction. I'm sorry about that. Robert Delaunay is also, Robert Delaunay is also in there. Not Sonia, though. That's interesting. But Magritte very much in there. Max Ernst, Salvador Dali. I mean, you know, good grief. I mean, I'd have said this is in the tradition of the Pinacoteca Moderna. Okay, it's not 20th century. It's contemporary, not modern. But hey, you know, this is surely a sense of humour failure by the gallery, isn't it?
Bring that man back. Give him his job back. Give him his installation back. It's good publicity. Everyone will be happy.
And I have to tell you, it didn't have to happen this way, because there was an incident a few months ago in Bonn in Germany, and staff were packing up an exhibit at the Bundeskunsthalle when they noticed an extra painting had been put on display by a member of the public. And they posted on social media, "We think it's funny, and we'd want to get them to know the artist. Get in touch." And the artist did get in touch, and the museum itself ended up auctioning the artist's work for charity, not sort of disposing of it or, you know, setting it on fire or anything like that. But, you know, something good came of it. Why do we think that the museum in Munich spectacularly failed to see the artistic side of things?
I agree. No sense of humour.
The other one showed them the way to do it.
Indeed, it did.
They've missed that moment, haven't they?
Well, we should end with some good taste on this edition of The Daily, because one of America's leading food publications is back in business 3 years after it seemed to have disappeared for good. Saveur magazine has not appeared in print since February 2021, and that's when it ended a 27-year run that had brought Americans closer to international cuisine than any ever before. And it was a magazine which transported readers to every region of the world, showing chefs and home cooks across the US there's more to life than cheeseburgers, barbecue, Tex-Mex, or America's version of Chinese food. That's a calumny, isn't it?
I think that's really unfair.
Uncalled for that. Nonetheless, yes. I didn't write this. Now, one pandemic and an economic downturn later, Saveur is back, as our Washington-based reporter Simon Marks explains.
We're at our holiday party, and we wanted to ask our friends, do you know how to pronounce the name of our magazine?
They've always been a lively bunch at Saveur magazine, and 12 years ago at the publication's Christmas party, they made no attempt to hide it. So how did the guests get along?
Saveur?
I prefer Saveur. I think it sounds fancier.
Saveur. But out in the West, sometimes I hear people say Savoir.
Saveur?
People say Saveur.
If I were in France, I would probably say Saveur. But since I'm in America, I say Saveur, and probably the strangest way that I've ever heard it pronounced is Savior, which I gotta say is a little weird, but also kind of wonderful.
More than a decade later, it is also very apt, because Saveur magazine has found its savior in the form of Kat Craddock.
I came from the restaurant industry before I moved over to media, and Saveur was always really important to me, and I wanted to make sure that that it continued. And we see magazines all the time folding and brands folding all the time. And I didn't want that to happen to us.
She is a former contributor to the magazine who is now its brand new editor-in-chief after taking the very bold and entrepreneurial decision to try and save it from the publishing scrap heap. She had watched Sever sold to new owners during the pandemic and then watched them scale back the magazine's operations and cancel its print run. A move that disappointed loyal subscribers whose enthusiasm for Sever and loyalty to the brand convinced Kat Craddock that there was something worth salvaging.
Sever has kind of always been a little bit more niche and a little bit weirder than other mass food brands. And that's not to say, I mean, it breaks my heart every time any food publication folds, and, you know, every quarter or every year when this happens, it's really disappointing for the whole industry. But, you know, I meet folks in the food and beverage industry all the time, whether they're chefs or food producers or restaurant owners, who tell me that they're longtime Sever readers and that they ended up in their line of work because of this publication. And I don't hear that about other brands.
If you need a lot of iceberg lettuce for salads or topping tacos, you want to remove the core to make chopping easier.
In addition to the magazine, she has also inherited Sever's massive archive of digital assets, including thousands of recipes and how-to videos.
So take a head of iceberg lettuce, make sure the core is pointing down, and slam it. Turn the head over and remove the core. It's just that easy.
Now, while that may be easy, some of Sever's classic recipes have required not just skill, but a fair bit of endurance, introducing Americans to a wide range of ingredients with which many of them were almost certainly unfamiliar.
Today, into the Sever kitchen, we are cooking with one of my favorite cheese of all the time, Montazio. Montazio is a delicious, creamier, nuttier cheese, perfect for melting, coming from the northeast region of Italy.
The magazine will continue its tradition of telling readers where they can acquire products that may not line the shelves of their nearest supermarket. And the first edition of the new print run includes the magazine's hallmark, richly photographed features from, among other places, Marseille, Japan, Lebanon, Italy, California, and even the moon, for an article about what humans might one day eat up there. Its editor says over the three decades since Sever first appeared, tastes in America have massively changed.
You're absolutely right. There were a lot of ingredients and techniques that at the time may have seemed really foreign to our readers. But, you know, our first cover story was about Oaxaca. And there, you know, there's a whole section in there about how you can't get mezcal in the United States. Well, 30 years later, it's one of the most popular spirits in the United States, you know, and I think that pushing those boundaries and getting those traditions out to a wider audience is noble and exciting. And, you know, we really love to be a part of that.
And she says while several other food and drink magazines in the United States also did not survive the pandemic nor the earlier audience shift to digital, it's the right time to relaunch a print product in a country where newspapers like the New York Times now see their food sections driving subscriptions and becoming, well, the meat and potatoes of their existence.
One thing that came out of the pandemic, obviously, the pandemic was a horrible situation, but people that came out of the pandemic came out much better cooks and much more adventurous cooks. And I think a lot more of people's time and energy and focus went into cooking for themselves at that time. And I think there are more adventurous people out there now that are willing to try new things. And I would love to tap into that. And we have a lot of loyal readers who've been with us from the very beginning. But of course, I would like to find new readers as well.
Kat Craddock acknowledges the scale of the task she has set herself and her colleagues. Initially, the magazine will be published just twice a year, with digital content and emailed newsletters used to spread awareness of Sever's return. It's a courageous project and a worthy effort to get readers to, in the words of the magazine's new tagline, eat the world. However you pronounce its name.
Sever. Everybody's saying Sever. It's Sever. It's not correct.
Sever.
That's a pretty good answer to that question. The sound of a plate breaking is how I pronounce the name of a magazine I can't pronounce.
For Monocle Radio, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
Sever, surely. That's all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panellists today, Patricia Cohen and Sean Ryan. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by George Ruskin. And our sound engineer was Lily Austin. I'm Guy Delaunay here in London. The Monocle Daily is back with me at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye, and thanks very much for listening.